Kurt's guest sir was okay again now. They could pretty well put the protocols of the mission behind them. They were Quantrill's boys now, two final Jayhawkers riding the western Massachusetts range. With an unmistakable little grimace of distaste, Freddy jerked a thumb at Perlmutter. "Want me to try waking him up, sir? He may be too far gone, but..." "Why bother?" Kurtz asked. Still gripping Freddy's shoulder, he pointed ahead, where the access road disappeared into a wall of white, the snow. The goddamn snow that had chased them all this way, a grim fucking reaper dressed in white instead of black. The tracks of the Subaru were now entirely gone, but those of the Humvee Owen had stolen were still visible. If they moved along briskly, praise God, following these tracks would be a walk in the park. "I don't think we need him anymore, which I personally find a great relief. Go, Freddy, go." The Humvee flirted her tail and then steadied. Kurtz drew his 9 and held it against his leg. "Coming for you, Owen. Coming for you, Buck. And you better get your speech ready for God, because you're going to be making it just about an hour from now." The office, which he had furnished so beautifully, furnished out of his mind and his memories, was now falling apart. Jonesy limped restlessly back and forth, looking around the room, lips pressed so tightly together they were white, forehead beaded with sweat even though it had gotten damned cold in here. This was the fall of the office of Jonesy instead of the House of Usher. The furnace was howling and clanking beneath him, making the floor shake. White stuff, frost crystals maybe, puffed in through the vent and left a powdery triangular shape on the wall. Where it touched, it went to work on the wood paneling, simultaneously rotting it and warping it. The pictures fell one by one, tumbling to the floor like suicides. The Eames chair, the one he'd always wanted, the very one, split in two as if it had been hacked by an invisible axe. The mahogany panels in the walls began to split and peel free like dead skin. The drawers juddered out of their places in the desk and clattered one by one to the floor. The shutters Mr. Gray had installed to block his view of the outside world were vibrating and shaking, producing a steady metallic squalling that set Jonesy's teeth on edge. Crying out to Mr. Gray, demanding to know what was going on, would be useless. And besides, Jonesy had all the information he needed. He had slowed Mr. Gray down, but Mr. Gray had first risen to the challenge and then above it. Viva Mr. Gray, who had either reached his goal or almost reached it. As the paneling fell off the walls, he could see the dirty sheetrock beneath. The walls of the Tracker Brothers' office, as four boys had seen it in 1978, lined up with their foreheads to the glass, their new chum standing behind them as bidden, waiting for them to be done with whatever it was they were doing, waiting for them to take him home. Now another wood panel tore loose, coming off the wall with a sound like tearing paper, and beneath it was a bulletin board with a single photo, a Polaroid, tacked to it. Not a beauty queen, not Tina Jean Slossinger, but just some woman with her skirt hiked to the bottom of her panties. Pretty stupid. The nice rug on the floor suddenly shriveled like skin, revealing dirty Tracker Brothers tile beneath and those white tadpoles, scumbags left by couples who came in here to screw beneath the disinterested gaze of the Polaroid woman, who was no one really, just an artifact of a hollow past. He paced, lurching on his bad hip, which hadn't hurt this badly since just after the accident, and he understood all of this. Oh, yes, indeed, you had better believe it. His hip was full of splinters and ground glass. His shoulders and neck ached with a fierce tiredness. Mr. Gray was beating his body to death as he made his final charge, and there was nothing Jonesy could do about it. The Dreamcatcher was still okay, swaying back and forth in great looping arcs, but still okay. Jonesy fixed his eyes on it. He had thought himself ready to die, but he didn't want to go like this, not in this stinking office. Outside of it, they had once done something good, something almost noble. To die in here, beneath the dusty, indifferent gaze of the woman pinned to the bulletin board, that didn't seem fair. Never mind the rest of the world. He, Gary Jones of Brookline, Massachusetts, once of Derry, Maine, lately of the Jefferson Tract, deserved better. "Please, I deserve better than this," he cried to the swaying cobweb shape in the air, and on the disintegrating desk behind him, the telephone rang. Jonesy wheeled around, groaning at the fiery, complicated pain in his hip. The phone on which he'd called Henry earlier had been his office phone, the blue trim line. The one on the cracked surface of the desk now was black and clunky, with a dial instead of buttons and a sticker on it reading, "May the Force be with you." It was the phone he'd had in his childhood room, the one his parents had given him for his birthday. 949-7784, the number to which he had charged the call to Duddett's all those years ago. He sprang for it, ignoring his hip, praying the line wouldn't disintegrate and disconnect before he could answer. "Hello? Hello?" Swaying back and forth on the shaking, vibrating floor, the whole office now going up and down like a ship on a heavy sea. Of all the voices he might have expected, Roberta's was the last. "Yes, doctor, hold on for your call." There was a click so loud it hurt his head, then silence. Jonesy groaned and was about to put the phone down when there was another click.
"Jonesy."
It was Henry. Faint, but undoubtedly Henry.
"Where are you?" Jonesy shouted. "Christ, Henry, the place is falling apart. I'm falling apart." "I'm in Goslin's," Henry said. "Only I'm not. Wherever you are, you're not. We're in the hospital where they took you after you got hit."
A crackle on the line, a buzz, and then Henry came back, sounding closer and stronger, sounding like a lifeline in all this disintegration.
"Not there either."
"What?"
"We're in the dream catcher, Jonesy. We're in the dream catcher, and we always were. Ever since 78. Duddett's is the dream catcher, but he's dying. He's holding on, but I don't know how long."
Another click, followed by another buzz, bitter and electric.
"Henry! Henry! Come out!"
Faint again now. Henry sounded desperate.
"You have to come out, Jonesy. Meet me. Run along the dream catcher and meet me. There's still time. We can take this son of a bitch. Do you hear me? We can..."
There was another click, and the phone went dead. The body of his childhood phone cracked, split open, and vomited out a senseless tangle of wires. All of them were red-orange. All of them were contaminated with a virus. Jonesy dropped the phone and looked up at the swaying dream catcher, that ephemeral cobweb. He remembered a line they'd been fond of as kids, pulled out of some comedian's routine, "Wherever you are, there you are." That had been right up there with "same shit, different day," had perhaps even taken over first place as they grew older and began to consider themselves sophisticated. "Wherever you are, there you are." Only according to Henry's call just now, that wasn't true. Wherever they thought they weren't. They were in the dream catcher. He noted that the one swaying in the air above the ruins of his desk had four central spokes radiating out from the center. Many connecting threads were held together by those spokes, but what held the spokes together was the center, the core, where they merged.
"Run along the dream catcher and meet me. There's still time."
Jonesy turned and sprinted for the door. Mr. Gray was also at a door, the one into the shaft house. It was locked. Considering what had happened with the Russian woman, this didn't surprise him much. Locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen was Jonesy's phrase for it. If he'd had one of the Kim, this would have been easy. As it was, he wasn't too perturbed. One of the interesting side effects of having emotions, he had discovered, was that they caused you to think ahead, plan ahead, so that you wouldn't trigger an all-out emotional attack if things went wrong. It might be one reason these creatures had survived as long as they had. Jonesy's suggestion that he give in to all this, "go native," had been his phrase for it, one that struck Mr. Gray as both mysterious and exotic, wouldn't quite leave his mind. But Mr. Gray pushed it aside. He would accomplish his mission here, satisfy the imperative. After that, who knew? Bacon sandwiches, perhaps. And what Jonesy's mind identified as a cocktail. This was a cool and refreshing drink, slightly intoxicating. A gust of wind rolled off the reservoir, slapping wet snow into his face, momentarily blinding him. It was like the snap of a wet towel, returning him to the here and now, where he had a job to finish. He sidled to the left on the rectangular granite stoop, slipped, then dropped to his knees, ignoring the howl from Jonesy's hip. He hadn't come all this way, black light years and white miles, either to fall back down the steps and break his neck, or to tumble into the Quabbin and die of hypothermia in that chilly water. The stoop had been placed atop a mound of crushed stone. Leaning over the left side of the stoop, he brushed snow away and began feeling for a loosed chunk. There were windows flanking the locked door, narrow, but not too narrow. Sound was tamped down and flattened by the heavy fall of wet snow, but he could hear the sound of an approaching motor. There had been another as well, but that one had already stopped, probably at the end of East Street. They were coming, but they were too late. It was a mile along the path, which was densely overgrown and slippery underfoot. By the time they got here, the dog would be down the shaft, drowning, and delivering the Byram into the aqueduct at the same time. He found a loose rock and pulled it free, working carefully so as not to dislodge the pulsing body of the dog around his shoulders. He backed away from the edge on his knees, then tried to get to his feet. At first he couldn't. The ball of Jonesy's hip had swelled tight again. He finally lurched upright, although the pain was incredible, seeming to go all the way up to his teeth and his temples. He stood for a moment, holding Jonesy's bad right leg a little off the ground like a horse with a stone in its hoof, bracing himself against the locked shafthouse door. When the pain had abated somewhat, he used the rock to beat the glass out of the window to the left of the door. He cut Jonesy's hand in several places, once deeply, and several cracked panes in the upper half of the window hung over the lower half like a cut-rate guillotine, but he paid no attention to these things, nor did he sense that Jonesy had finally left his bolt hole. Mr. Gray squirmed in through the window, landed on the cold concrete floor, and looked around. He was in a rectangular room about 30 feet long. At the far end, a window, which no doubt would have given a spectacular view of the reservoir on a clear day, showed only white, as if a sheet had been tacked over it. To one side of it was what looked like a gigantic steel pail, its sides speckled with red. Not virus, but an oxide Jonesy identified as rust. Mr. Gray didn't know for sure, but guessed that men could be lowered down the shaft in the bucket should some emergency require it. The iron cover, 4 feet across, was in place, seated dead center in the middle of the floor. He could see the square notch on one side of it and looked around. A few tools leaned against the wall. One of them, in a scatter of glass from the broken window, was a crowbar, quite possibly the same one the Russian woman had used as she prepared for her suicide. "Way I heard it," Mr. Gray thought. "The folks in Boston'll be drinking that last Byram in their morning coffee right around Valentine's Day." He seized the crowbar, limped painfully to the center of the room, with his breath puffing cold and white before him, then seated the spatulate end of the tool in the slot of the cover. The fit was perfect. Henry racks the telephone, takes in a deep breath, holds it, and then runs for the door, which is marked both office and private. "Hey!" old Renee Goslin squawks from her place at the cash register. "Come back here, kid! You can't go in there!" Henry doesn't stop, doesn't even slow, but as he goes through the door, he realizes that, yeah, he is a kid, at least a foot shy of his final height, and although he's wearing specs, they're nowhere near as heavy as they will be later on. He's a kid, but under all that flopping hair, which will have thinned a bit by the time he hits his 30s, there is an adult's brain. "I'm two mints in one," he thinks. And as he bursts into old man Goslin's office, he is cackling madly, laughing like they did in the old days, when the strands of the dreamcatcher were all close to the center and Duddits was running their pegs. "I almost busted a gut," they used to say. "I almost busted a gut. What a fucking pisser." Into the office he goes. But it's not old man Goslin's office, where a man named Owen Underhill once played a man whose name was not Abraham Kurtz, a tape of the Gray Boys talking in famous voices. It is a corridor. It is a hospital corridor. And Henry is not in the least surprised. It's Mass General. He's made it. The place is dank, colder than any hospital corridor should be, and the walls are splotched with virus. Somewhere, a voice is groaning, "I don't want you. I don't want a shot. I want Jonesy.
Jonesy knew Duddits. Jonesy died. Died in the ambulance. Jonesy's the only one who will do. Stay away. Kiss my bender. I want Jonesy.
But he will not stay away. He is crafty old Mr. Death, and he will not stay away. He has business here. He walks unseen down the corridor, where it's cold enough for him to see his breath puffing out in front of him. A boy in an orange coat he will soon outgrow. He wishes he had his rifle, the one Pete's dad loaned him, but that rifle is gone, left behind, buried in the years along with Jonesy's phone and the Star Wars sticker on it. How they had all envied that phone, and Beaver's jacket of many zippers, and Pete's sweater with the NASA logo on the breast. Buried in the years. Some dreams die and fall free. That is another of the world's bitter truths. How many bitter truths there are. He walks past a pair of laughing, talking nurses. One of them is Josie Rinkenhauer, all grown up, and the other is the woman in the Polaroid photograph they saw that day through the Tracker Brothers' office window. They don't see him because he's not here for them. He is in the dream catcher now, running back along his strand, running toward the center. I am the Eggman, he thinks. Time slowed, reality bent, and on the Eggman went. Henry went on up the corridor toward the sound of Mr. Gray's voice. Kurtz heard it clearly enough through the shattered window, the broken stutter of automatic rifle fire. It provoked an old sense of unease and impatience in him, anger that the shooting had started without him, and fear that it would be over before he got there. Nothing left but the wounded yelling, "Medic, medic, medic." Push it harder, Freddy. Directly in front of Kurtz, Perlmutter was snoring ever deeper into his coma. Pretty greasy underfoot, boss. Push it anyway. I've got a feeling we're almost... He saw a pink stain on the clean white curtain of the snow, as diffuse as blood from a facial cut seeping up through shaving cream. And then the ditched Subaru was right in front of them, nose down and tail up. In the following moments, Kurtz took back every unkind thought he'd had about Freddy's driving. His second-in-command simply twisted the steering wheel to the right and punched the gas when the Humvee started to skid. The big vehicle took hold and leapt at the break in the road. It hit with a tremendous jouncing crash. Kurtz flew upward, hitting the ceiling hard enough to produce a shower of stars in his field of vision. Perlmutter's arms flailed like those of a corpse. His head snapped backward and then forward. The Humvee passed close enough to the Subaru to tear the door handle off the car's passenger side. Then it was bucketing onward, now chasing a single pair of relatively fresh tire tracks. Breathing down your neck now, Owen, Kurtz thought. Right down your ever-loving neck, God rot your blue eyes. The only thing that worried him was that single burst of fire. What was that about? Whatever it wasn't repeated. Then, up ahead, another of those blotches in the snow. This one was olive green. This one was the other Hummer. They were gone, probably gone, but... Lock and load, Kurtz said to Freddy. His voice was just a trifle shrill. It's time for someone to pay the piper. By the time Owen got to the place where East Street ended, or turned into the northeast meandering Fitzpatrick Road, depending on your interpretation, he could hear Kurtz behind him, and guessed that Kurtz could probably hear him as well. The Humvees weren't as loud as Harley's, but they were a long way from quiet. Jonesy's footprints were entirely gone now, but Owen could see the path which led down from the road and along the shore of the reservoir. He killed the engine. Henry, it looks like we're walking from here. Owen stopped. He had been concentrating too hard on his driving to look behind him or even check the rearview mirror, and he was unprepared for what he now saw. Unprepared and appalled. Henry and Duddits were wrapped in what Owen first believed was a terminal embrace. Their stubbly cheeks pressed together, their eyes closed, their faces and coats smeared with blood. He could see neither of them breathing, and thought they had actually died together, Duddits of his leukemia, Henry perhaps of a heart attack brought on by exhaustion and by the constant unrelieved stress of the last 30 hours or so. And then he saw the minute twitch of the eyelids, both sets, embracing, splattered with blood, but not dead, sleeping. dreaming. Owen started to call Henry's name again, and then reconsidered. Henry had refused to leave the compound back in Jefferson Tract without freeing the detainees, and although they'd gotten away with that one, it had only been through the sheerest luck or providence, if you believe that was any more than a TV show. Nevertheless, they had gotten Kurtz on their tail, and Kurtz had hung on like a booger, and now he was a lot closer than he would have been had Owen and Henry simply crept out into the storm. Well, I wouldn't change that, Owen thought, opening the driver's door and getting out. Somewhere north, away in the white blank of the storm, came the scream of an eagle bitching about the weather. From behind, south, came the approaching racket of Kurtz, that annoying madman. It was impossible to tell how close because of the fucking snow. Coming down this fast and hard, it was like a sound baffle. He could be 2 miles back, he could be a lot closer. Freddy would be with him, fucking Freddy, the perfect soldier, Dolph Lundgren from hell. Owen went around to the back of the car, slipping and sliding in the snow, cursing it, and popped the Humvee's back gate, expecting automatic weapons, hoping for a portable rocket launcher. No rocket launcher, no grenades either, but there were 4 MP5 auto-fire rifles and a carton containing long banana clips, the ones that held 120 rounds. He had played it Henry's way back at the compound, and Owen guessed that they had saved at least some lives, but he would not play it Henry's way this time. If he hadn't paid enough for the Rapallo's goddamn serving platter, he would simply have to live with the debt. Not for long, either, if Kurtz had his way. Henry was either sleeping, unconscious, or joined to his dying childhood friend in some weird mind meld. Let it be, then. Awake, and by his side, Henry might balk at what needed to be done, especially if Henry was right in believing his other friend was still alive, hiding out in the mind the alien now controlled. Owen would not balk, and with the telepathy gone, he wouldn't hear Jonesy pleading for his life if he was still in there. The Glock was a good weapon, but not sure enough. The MP5 would rip the body of Gary Jones apart. Owen grabbed one, plus 3 extra clips which he stuffed into his coat pockets. Kurt's close now. Close, close, close. He looked back at East Street, almost expecting to see the second Humvee materializing like a green-brown ghost, but as yet, there was nothing. Praise Jesus, as Kurtz would say. The Hummer's windows were already glazing over with snow, but he could see the dim shapes of the 2 men in the rear seat as he passed back along the body of the vehicle, trotting now, still locked in each other's arms. "Goodbye, boys," he said. "Sleep well." And, with any luck, they would still be sleeping when Kurtz and Freddy arrived, putting an end to their lives before moving on after their main quarry. Owen stopped suddenly, skidding in the snow and grabbing the Humvee's long hood to keep from falling. Duddits was clearly a lost cause, but he might be able to save Henry Devlin. It was just possible. "No," part of his mind screamed as he started back for the rear door. "No, there's no time." But Owen decided to gamble that there was, to gamble the whole world. Maybe to pay a little more on what he owed for the Rapallo's plate, maybe for what he had done yesterday, those naked gray figures standing around their downed ship with their arms held up as if in surrender. Probably just for Henry, who had told him they would be heroes, and who had tried, splendidly, to fulfill that promise. No sympathy for the devil, he thought, wrenching open the rear door. No, sir, zero sympathy for that motherfucker. Duddits was closer. Owen seized him by the collar of his big blue duffel coat and yanked. Duddits toppled sideways onto the seat. His hat fell off, revealing his shining, bald skull. Henry, with his arms still around Duddits's shoulders, came with him, landing on top. His eyes didn't open, but he groaned softly. Owen leaned forward and whispered fiercely into Henry's ear, "Don't sit up! For the love of God, Henry, don't you sit up!" Owen withdrew, slammed the door, backed off 3 steps, placed the butt of the rifle against his hip, and fired a burst. The Humvee's windows turned to milk, then fell in. Casings clinked around Owen's feet. He stepped forward again and looked through the shattered window into the rear seat. Henry and Duddits still lay there, now covered with crumbles of safety glass as well as Duddits's blood, and to Owen, they looked like the 2 deadest people he had ever seen. Owen hoped Kurtz would be in too much of a hurry for a close examination. In any case, He had done the best he could. He heard a hard, metallic jouncing sound and grinned. That place Kurtz, by God. They'd reached the washout where the Subaru had finished up. He wished mightily that Kurtz and Freddy had rear-ended the fucking thing, but the sound had not, unfortunately, been that loud. Still, it placed them. A mile back at least. Not as bad as he'd thought. Plenty of time, he muttered. And that might be true of Kurtz, but what about the other end? Where was Mr. Gray now? Holding the MP5 by the strap, Owen started down the path that led to Shaft 12. Mr. Gray had discovered another unlovely human emotion. Panic. He had come all this way, light years through space, miles through the snow, to be balked by Jonesy's muscles, which were weak and out of shape, and the iron shaft cover, which was much heavier than he had expected. He yanked down on the crowbar until Jonesy's back muscles screamed in agonized protest, and was finally rewarded by a brief wink of darkness from beneath the edge of the rusty iron, and a grinding sound as it moved a bit, perhaps no more than an inch or two, on the concrete. Then Jonesy's lower back muscles locked up, and Mr. Gray staggered away from the shaft, crying out through clenched teeth. Thanks to his immunity, Jonesy still had a full set of them, and pressing his hands to the base of Jonesy's spine as if to keep it from exploding. Lad let out a series of yipping whines. Mr. Gray looked at him and saw that things had now reached the critical juncture. Although he was still asleep, Lad's abdomen was now so grotesquely swelled that one of his legs stuck stiffly up in the air. The skin of his lower belly had stretched to the point of splitting, and the veins there pulsed with clock-like rapidity. A trickle of bright blood spilled out from beneath his tail. Mr. Gray looked balefully at the crowbar jutting from the slot in the iron cover. In Jonesy's imagination, the Russian woman had been a slim beauty with dark hair and dark, tragic eyes. In reality, Mr. Gray thought, she must have been broad-shouldered and muscular. How else could she have... There was a blast of gunfire, alarmingly close. Mr. Gray gasped and looked around. Thanks to Jonesy, the human corrosion of doubt was also part of his makeup now, and for the first time he realized that he might be balked. Yes, even here, so close to his goal that he could hear it, the sound of rushing water starting on its 60-mile underground journey. And all that stood between the Byram and this whole world was a circular iron plate weighing 120 pounds. Screaming a thin and desperate litany of beaver curses, Mr. Gray rushed forward, Jonesy's failing body jerking back and forth on the defective pivot point of its right hip. One of them was coming, the one called Owen, and Mr. Gray dared not believe he could make this Owen turn his weapon on himself. Given time, given the element of surprise, maybe. Now he had neither. And this man who was coming had been trained to kill. It was his career. Mr. Gray leaped into the air. There was a snap, quite audible, as Jonesy's overstressed hip broke free of the swollen socket which had held it. Mr. Gray landed on the crowbar with Jonesy's full weight. The edge lifted again, and this time the cover slid almost a foot across the concrete. The black crescent through which the Russian woman had slipped appeared again. Not much of a crescent, really no more than a delicate capital C drawn with a calligrapher's pen, but enough for the dog. Jonesy's leg would no longer support Jonesy's weight, and where was Jonesy anyway? Still not a murmur from his troublesome host. But that was all right. Crawling would do now. Mr. Gray worked his way in such fashion across the cold cement floor to where the sleeping border collie lay, seized Lad by his collar, and began to drag him back to Shaft 12. The Hall of Memories, that vast repository of boxes, is also on the verge of shaking itself apart. The floor shudders as if in the grip of an endless, slow earthquake. Overhead, the fluorescents flicker on and off, giving the place a stuttery, hallucinatory look. In places, tall stacks of cartons have fallen over, blocking some of the corridors. Jonesy runs as best he can. He moves from corridor to corridor, threading his way through this maze purely on instinct. He tells himself repeatedly to ignore the goddamn hip. He has nothing but mind now, anyway. but he might as well be an amputee trying to convince his missing limb to stop throbbing. He runs past boxes marked Austro-Hungarian War and Departmental Politics and Children's Stories and Contents of Upstairs Closet. He hurdles a pile of tumbled boxes marked Carla, comes down on his bad leg and screams at the pain. He clutches more boxes, those marked Gettysburg, in order to keep from falling, and at last sees the far side of the storage room. Thank God, it seems to him that he has run miles. The door is marked ICU, and Quiet Please, and No Visitors Without Pass. And that is right. This is where they took him. This is where he had awakened and heard crafty old Mr. Death pretending to call for Marcy. Jonesy bangs through the door and into another world, one he recognizes. The blue over white ICU corridor where he took his first painful tentative steps 4 days after his surgery. He stumbles a dozen feet down the tiled corridor, sees the splotches of virus growing on the walls, hears the Muzak, which is decidedly unhospital-like. Although it's turned low, it appears to be the Rolling Stones singing Sympathy for the Devil. He has no more than identified this song when his hip suddenly goes nuclear. Jonesy utters a surprised scream and falls to the black and red ICU tiles, clutching at himself. This is how it was just after he was hit, an explosion of red agony. He rolls over and over, looking up at the glowing light panels, at the circular speakers from which the music, Anastasia screamed in vain, is coming, music from another world. When the pain is this bad, everything is in another world. Pain makes a shadow of substance and a mockery even of love. That is something he learned in March and must learn again now. He rolls and he rolls, hands clutching at his swollen hip, eyes bulging, mouth pulled back in a vast rictus, and he knows what has happened, all right. Mr. Gray, that son of a bitch, Mr. Gray, has rebroken his hip. Then, from far away in that other world, he hears a voice he knows. A kid's voice.
Jonesy!
Echoing, distorted, but not that far away. Not this corridor, but one of the adjacent ones. Whose voice? One of his own kids? John, maybe? No.
Jonesy, you have to hurry. He's coming to kill you. Owen is coming to kill you.
He doesn't know who Owen is, but he knows who that voice belongs to, Henry Devlin. But not as it is now, or as it was when he last saw Henry going off to Goslin's Market with Pete. This is the voice of the Henry he grew up with. The one who told old Richie Grenadeau that they'd tell on him if he didn't stop, that Richie and his friends would never catch Pete because Pete ran like the fucking wind.
I can't, he calls back, still rolling on the floor.
He is aware that something has changed, is still changing, but not what.
I can't. He broke my hip again. The son of a bitch broke.
And then he realizes what is happening to him. The pain is running backward. It is like watching a videotape as it rewinds. The milk flows up from the glass to the carton. The flower, which should be blooming, through the miracle of time-lapse photography, closes up instead. The reason is obvious when he looks down at himself and sees the bright orange jacket he's wearing. It's the one his mother bought him in Sears for his first hunting trip to Hole in the Wall, the trip when Henry got his deer, and they all killed Richie Grenadeau and his friends. Killed them with a dream, maybe not meaning to, but doing it just the same. He has become a child again, a kid of 14, and there is no pain. Why would there be? His hip will not be broken for another 23 years. And then it all comes together with a crash in his mind. There was never any Mr. Gray, not really. Mr. Gray lives in the dream catcher and nowhere else. He is no more real than the pain in his hip. I was immune, he thinks, getting up. I never got so much as a speck of the virus. What's in my head isn't quite a memory, not that, but a true ghost in the machine. He's me. Dear God, Mr. Gray is me. Jonesy scrambles to his feet and begins to run, almost losing his feet as he swerves around a corner. He stays up, though. He is agile and quick as only a 14-year-old can be, and there is no pain. No pain. The next corridor is one he knows. There is a parked gurney with a bedpan on it. Walking past it, moving delicately on tiny feet, is the deer he saw that day in Cambridge just before he was struck. There is a collar around its velvety neck, and swinging from it, like an oversized amulet, is his magic eight ball. Jonesy sprints past the deer, which looks at him with mild, surprised eyes.
Jonesy!
Close now, very close.
Jonesy! Hurry!
Jonesy redoubles his speed, feet flying, young lungs breathing easily. There is no virus because he is immune. There is no Mr. Gray, not in him, at least. Mr. Gray is in the hospital, and always was. Mr. Gray is the phantom limb you still feel, the one you could swear is still there. Mr. Gray is the ghost in the machine, the ghost on life support, and the life support is him. He turns another corner. Here are three doors which are standing open. Beyond them, by the fourth door, the only one that is closed, Henry is standing. Henry is 14, as Jonesy is. Henry is wearing an orange coat, as Jonesy is. His glasses have slid down on his nose, just as they always did, and he is beckoning urgently.
Hurry up! Hurry up, Jonesy! Duddits can't hold on much longer! If he dies before we kill Mr. Gray...
Jonesy joins Henry at the door. He wants to throw his arms around him, embrace him, but there's no time.
This is all my fault, he tells Henry.
And his voice is higher in pitch than it has been in years.
Not true, Henry says.
He is looking at Jonesy with the old impatience that awed Jonesy and Pete and Beaver as children. Henry always seemed further ahead, always on the verge of sprinting into the future and leaving the rest of them behind. They always seemed to be holding him back.
But you might as well say that Duddits murdered Richie Grenadoe and that we were his accomplices.
He was what he was, Jonesy, and he made us what we are, but not on purpose. It was all he could do to tie his shoes on purpose, don't you know that? And Jonesy thinks,
fit what? Fit Nick?
Henry, is Duddits? He's holding on for us, Jonesy, I told you, he's holding us together. In the dream catcher.
That's right. So are we going to stand out here arguing in the hall while the world goes down the shooter, or are we going to...
We're going to kill the son of a bitch, Jonesy says, and reaches for the doorknob. Above it is a sign reading, there is no infection here. Il n'y a pas d'infection ici. And suddenly, he sees both of that sign's bitter edges. It's like one of those Escher optical illusions. Look at it from one angle, and it's true. Look at it from another, and it's the most monstrous lie in the universe. Dreamcatcher, Jonesy thinks, and turns the knob. The room beyond the door is a virus madhouse, a nightmare jungle overgrown with creepers and vines and lianas twisted together in blood-colored plates. The air reeks of sulfur and chili ethyl alcohol, the smell of starter fluid sprayed into a bulky carb on a sub-zero January morning. At least they don't have the shit weasel to worry about, not in here. That's on another strand of the Dreamcatcher, in another place and time. The Byram is Lad's problem now. He's a border collie with a very dim future. The television is on, and although the screen is overgrown with virus, a ghostly black-and-white image comes straining through. A man is dragging the corpse of a dog across a concrete floor. Dusty and strewn with dead autumn leaves, it's like a tomb in one of the 50s horror flicks Jonesy still likes to watch on his VCR. But this isn't a tomb. It is filled with the hollow sound of rushing water. In the center of the floor, there is a rusty circular cover with MWRA stamped on it, Massachusetts Water Resources Authority. Even through the reddish scrum on the TV screen, these letters stand out. Of course they do. To Mr. Gray, who died as a physical being all the way back at Hole in the Wall, they mean everything. They mean, quite literally, the world. The shaft lid has been partly pushed aside, revealing a crescent shape of absolute darkness. The man dragging the dog is himself, Jonesy realizes, and the dog isn't quite dead. It is leaving a trail of frothy pink blood behind on the concrete, and its back legs are twitching, almost paddling.
Never mind the movie, Henry almost snarls.
And Jonesy turns his attention to the figure in the bed, the gray thing with the virus-speckled sheet pulled up to its chest, which is a plain gray expanse of poreless, hairless, nippleless flesh. Although he can't see now because of the sheet, Jonesy knows there is no navel either, because this thing was never born. It is a child's rendering of an alien, trolled directly from the subconscious minds of those who first came in contact with the Byram. They never existed as actual creatures, aliens, ETs. The Greys, as physical beings, were always created out of the human imagination, out of the dreamcatcher, and knowing this affords Jonesy a measure of relief. He wasn't the only one who got fooled. At least there is that. Something else pleases him. The look in those horrid black eyes. It's fear. "I'm locked and loaded," Freddy said quietly, drawing to a stop behind the Humvee they had chased all these miles. "Outstanding," Kurtz said. "Recon that HMW, I'll cover you." "Right." Freddy looked at Perlmutter, whose belly was swelling again, then at Owen's Hummer. The reason for the rifle fire they'd heard earlier was clear now. The Hummer had been shot up pretty good. The only question left to be answered was who had been on the giving end and who on the receiving. Tracks led away from the Hummer, growing indistinct under the rapid snowfall, but for now clear enough to read. A single set. Boots. Probably Owen. "Go on now, Freddy." Freddy got out into the snow. Kurtz slid out behind him, and Freddy heard him rack the slide of his personal. Depending on the 9mm, well, maybe that was all right. He was good with it, no question of that. Freddy felt a momentary coldness down his spine, as if Kurtz had the 9 leveled there, right there. But that was ridiculous, wasn't it? Owen, yes, but Owen was different. Owen had crossed the line. Freddy hurried to the Hummer, bent low, carbine held at chest level. He didn't like having Kurtz behind him. That was undeniable. No, he didn't like that at all. As the two boys advance on the overgrown bed, Mr. Gray begins to push the call button repeatedly, but nothing happens. "I think the works must be choked with virus," Jonesy thinks. "Too bad, Mr. Gray. Too bad for you." He glances up at the TV and sees that his film self has gotten the dog to the edge of the shaft. Maybe they're too late after all. Maybe not. There's no way to tell. The wheel is still spinning. "Hello, Mr. Gray. I've so much wanted to meet you," Henry says. As he speaks, he removes the virus-splotched pillow from beneath Mr. Gray's narrow, earless head. Mr. Gray tries to wriggle toward the other side of the bed, but Jonesy holds him in place, grasping the alien's child-thin arms. The skin in his hands is neither hot nor cold. It doesn't feel like skin at all, not really. It feels like nothing, he thinks. Like a dream. "Mr. Gray," Henry asks, "this is how we say welcome to planet Earth." And he puts the pillow over Mr. Gray's face. Beneath Jonesy's hands, Mr. Gray begins to struggle and thrash. Somewhere a monitor begins to beep frantically, as if this creature actually has a heart and that it has now stopped beating. Jonesy looks down at the dying monster and wishes only for this to be over. Mr. Gray got the dog to the side of the shaft he had partially uncovered. Coming up through the narrow black semicircle was the steady hollow rush of running water and a waft of dank, cold air. "If it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly." That from a box marked Shakespeare.